welcome to the Speech Uncensored podcast. Today is a little special as your regular host, Leanne Porter, passed the microphone off to me. I'm Sarah Barr, and I'm going to be your guest host today. I'm the creator of Honeycomb Speech Therapy, and I've been honored to be a past guest on this podcast several times to talk about person-centered care topics. And today, I have a real treat for us all. You'll be listening to a conversation about meaningful dementia care and speech therapy. There is no one better to talk to today about this topic than our esteemed guest, Dr. Michelle Bourgeois. Dr. Bourgeois is a retired professor in the Department of Communication, Sciences, and Disorders at the University of South Florida. She is an ASHA fellow, and she has received numerous grants to evaluate memory aids and interventions for persons with dementia, aphasia, and traumatic brain injury, to develop interventions for spousal and nursing home caregivers designed to improve the quality and quantity of communication interactions with residents with dementia, and to develop training programs for institutional caregivers. Michelle's publications, research, and teaching have been groundbreaking in our field and perspective shifting for me personally. Our show notes from our conversation today are going to be full of resources that will be helpful to you if you work with the dementia population, and they will be available at speechuncensored.com. Welcome, Michelle. We are so glad to have you here today.
Thank you so much, Sarah. I'm very honored to be invited to share whatever knowledge I can impart with you today.
Wonderful. Well, I thought, you know, you have just been a pioneer in our field, a maverick in envisioning the ways that we can be important in the care team for people with dementia as speech language pathologists. And I thought it would be fun to start with you describing how you've seen our role shift and change over the course of your career.
Well, I have been truly blessed to have been in the right place at the right time. When I was a student doing my externship at the VA almost 40 years ago, dementia was a brand new diagnosis. People had just discovered it, and we had clients who came to the clinic requesting assistance. They wanted help with their problems, word-finding problems in conversation. And my supervisor gave me the challenge. He said, figure it out. You know, we've never seen this population before. Try and see what you can do. So that's how it started. And, you know, I feel like I was just so lucky to have attempted to solve the problem practically by figuring out how you could help someone in the moment have a better conversation, find those words they wanted to use. And that's how I came up with the memory wallet, which to me was just basically a cheat sheet, you know?
Right.
I talked to the person about what they wanted to talk about in their conversations and write down the words, write down phrases, and then I thought to add pictures, and the rest is history. I mean, it just kept going on from there. As we had different clients and they had different types and severities of dementia, I just simply modified the details of the memory books and from the memory wallet to memory books to any kind of written cueing system for that person for whatever was their problem. So that gave me the insight that has guided my career, basically, and the research that I've done and my teaching about how to work with people with dementia. And basically, it is that instead of how we were originally trained, which is to see a client, sort of guess at what their problems were, give them some kind of a comprehensive assessment, and then figure out what they needed, I think we need to flip the rehab model and start by asking people what is a problem for them. And then when we sort of identify what's involved with that problem, then we selectively assess what we need to document for whatever reimbursement situation we're in.
Yeah, that really, it makes so much sense how you talk about it. Like, of course, that's what we're trying to do in speech therapy, is to meet real needs. But that definitely hasn't been the way that we've been kind of traditionally doing things, especially in skilled nursing facilities. So I know your textbook on communication aids, for example, has just been so helpful in thinking through the different needs that we could use our speech therapy time to meet. And we'll definitely put those references in our show notes. I thought maybe you could kind of walk us through what an assessment might look like, because there were, on one hand, we're kind of having pressure, especially in facility type of settings, like, oh, it's all about that impairment-based testing. We have to do those, just get kind of all of the, what severity rating are you for attention or memory or problem solving? And then we're trying to work from those results, which feels very difficult. So I love your idea about flipping the rehab model, and I just would love to hear you kind of walk through what that might look like.
Okay. So let me just say, first of all, our impairment-based measures, our standardized assessment tools, are designed for diagnosis. And when you're in a SNF and you have a patient with dementia, they have already been diagnosed with dementia. You don't have to do that again. What your role should be is to figure out what to do for them for therapy, what they need, and how you can support them. So my assessment protocol is to start out with their sensory needs. I first need to know how well they see and hear, because I'm going to be designing cues and stimulus materials for them that are based on their sensory needs. So the first thing I usually do is ask the nursing staff if they have hearing aids and glasses, and make sure that you have those to begin with before you do anything else. Then what I do is I talk to the person. I ask them how they're doing, what they wish they would be able to be doing, what they like to be doing, those kinds of things. And if the person has difficulty expressing that, there are other resources that you can use to get information about that person. Most every SNF I have encountered has some kind of a protocol for the family to write a social history of that individual that says, you know, where they were from, what they did for a living, what their family's constituted, their hobbies, their interests. That stuff should be written down somewhere. And, you know, it's great that facilities do that, but unfortunately, once they do, they lock it up in the...
Where does it go?
Right. It goes into outer space, I guess. But I think all you have to do is ask for it and get that. You'll get an idea before you even meet your patient of who they are and what their educational level has been and what some interests are. And then you can talk to them more personally about what it is that they enjoy. And then if you find out that, say, for instance, they used to read a lot and they had a book club they used to go to, and that could be something that they might still enjoy doing, if you, as the clinician, figured out what kind of barriers existed in the environment or with that person to prevent that from happening. So you need to know what size font the person can read easily. You need to find out if there is a book club or any kind of activity around reading materials in that facility that that person could be invited to. And if they can't remember to go to it on their own, there you go. You have a memory goal right there to help them remember how to go to their book club or to whatever activity they're not attending that they've been offered. In order to document for a memory issue like that, for that type of goal, something short and quick is all you need to say, oh, this person has a memory problem, you know, and you are not going to measure the outcome of the therapy or whatever you do to help support that person with that memory issue, you're going to document how successful that person is in getting to and participating in their book club. So engagement for me in the nursing home is probably one of the biggest target goals that I try and figure out ways to help that person engage with their environment.
When when I hear you talking and giving those examples, it's very much what you're impacting is the amount of time someone is able to participate in something or spend their time in a meaningful way. And just that idea alone, I think, will be a mind shift for some people, because we're, even in skilled nursing facilities, still feeling like we're having to like show, you know, improvement on memory testing scores, which of course isn't really going to happen, especially with the dementia population. So I love that life participation approach where it's not really about improving the impairment. It's about providing the supports and the environment so that someone can spend their time in a more meaningful way. Am I summarizing that in a way you agree with?
Exactly right. Okay. And one of the things I'm most proud of all the research I have done over the past 30, 40 years, is the fact that my research demonstrates that people with dementia have preserved reading ability until death. Even at the end of life, people can still process, their brain processes it. It is an automatic, unconscious ability. We often think that reading is a higher order cognitive skill, when in fact, I really believe it's a lower level. It's an automatic procedural memory. You cannot prevent somebody from processing letters into words unless the only way you can do that, avoid that, is to have them close their eyes. Their brain automatically processes it. And therefore, you can use the written word for so many things. I mean, if any of your listeners have followed any of the Montessori for dementia applications in nursing homes and seen any of the video that you can access on YouTube about that approach, you will see people who have severe dementia who are reading out loud in reading groups very complicated material. It's not simplified.
Right. Not just like a single word or anything.
Right. Right. Exactly. It is long numbers and complicated information. And one would not expect that based on what our assumptions are about dementia. And it's amazing to see that their abilities are still in there. It's just a matter of cueing.
Yes.
It's giving them the right cues, and then you can demonstrate all kinds of behaviors that are things that we want to maintain and that are satisfying to them in their lives.
And, you know, thinking about then that preserved reading ability, and from some of the articles and the texts that you've put out, I mean, we could use reading supports, written supports for so many needs. So you kind of gave the example of like a meaningful way to spend time, being part of a reading group. We can also use those supports for things like sequencing or safety or mealtime cues, telling someone something about yourself. I mean, I can see as I'm thinking through various clients and scenarios that we would want to consider that to meet just a huge variety of needs.
Let me just interject that one of the astounding outcomes of the Montessori approach and the use of written cues has been the effect it has had on dehydration in nursing homes. In Australia, they put up a sign that says, "Please have a drink of water," and a little table with a pitcher of water and some cups. And every time a person with dementia walked by, they read the sign and they took a drink. They totally eliminated dehydration, which eliminated all that confusion that caused people to be given psychotropic medications. They completely eliminated the need for psychotropic medication in that facility. So using signs like that, you can get people to engage in all kinds of activities. So remember in preschool how we have little stations of activity things and kids rotate through that? In a nursing home, you can put up activity stations with a sign that says, please fold the laundry, please polish the silverware, please polish the shoes, whatever. Things that are meaningful things, and people sit down, you know, they walk by, read the sign. Oh, okay, I can do that. They sit down and they do it. It is absolutely amazing to see the difference in people.
We will definitely share the YouTube video that you're talking about also. And I'm thinking like some of our listeners may not have heard of the Montessori approach. So let's like back up and why don't you kind of explain, it's not a treatment intervention. It's really a philosophy and there's a certification. Right. So why don't you give us some more info about that? So
I have some friends around the world who are all devoted to improving nursing home care. One in Australia, one in Canada, and Jennifer Brush, who's in Ohio. And many of you probably heard of her and the research products that she has researched and the tools that she's developed. The four of us had the opportunity to interact and to share ideas. And our friend in Australia introduced us to the Montessori application in the nursing home that she was doing. And it's important to remember this is not the same, that's not the same procedure as Montessori is done with children, because this is not an educational system. What we have done is taken some of the principles of Maria Montessori's educational approach that are applicable to people of all ages and have put them together into a model that we call the Montessori for Dementia and Aged Care approach. And the philosophy or the aspects of it that we've taken include having a prepared environment. So with children, materials are prepared and children can do them independently. And that's exactly what we do with the elders. We prepare materials that are self-evident. A person understands immediately upon sitting down to how to do them. Very simple. Or they might need just one demonstration and then they can do them. They also, a prepared environment uses signs. Yes. So that's where my work comes in. Yes. That's why I'm involved in it. Because using the written word, having written instructions, having signs, enables people to be independent. They walk by that little table with the water pitcher, they read, please have a drink, and they do it. So that's one of the principles. The second principle is that they have a role in the community, that they have something that makes them feel like they're connected to their community. So we always try to figure out what that person's occupation had been and then figure out some little job in the community that we can invite them to do that makes them feel proud that they're contributing to the environment, to their community. So, for example, one lady was a homemaker and she had a garden. So we invited her to decorate the dining room tables with vases with flowers in them.
Oh, I love that.
And we had a flower station and 10 vases, because there were only 10 tables, so it's a failure-free activity. We invited her to decorate the tables with these fake flowers. And every morning she would go to the station, get down the 10 vases, put flowers in them, put them on a rolling cart, roll it to the dining room, distribute them after breakfast, take them all back, undo everything, and right before lunch, repeat the whole process, and right before dinner, repeat the whole process. And people would say, oh my, that seems very repetitive and boring. But no, the beauty of it is, for someone with dementia, it is a familiar activity that they can do by themselves easily, and they're proud because it's beautifying the environment. So there are lots of little jobs that you can come up with. And in the videos of the Montessori approach, you'll see a bunch of those in action.
Wow.
One of them is, you know, baking cookies and then taking cookies and giving cookies to the staff. Somebody is the mailman, goes around and distributes mail, you know, dusting.
Yes.
People, women who are housekeepers, love to dust.
I've had clients like that too. I don't think that will be my gift when I age, but I appreciate that some people do.
Exactly. Taking care of pets. I mean, in the U.S., it's just, well, in Florida anyway, it's amazing to me that all these nursing homes allow residents to have a pet. So pet care is also an important thing. And the more able people might be, dog walkers or, you know, whatever. It's just a matter of being a little creative and finding something. But those principles of Montessori are the ones that we've adopted or taken from the overall Montessori approach. And we have researched it. We, you know, there's some articles in the handout that we've prepared for today to show you that. But again, it's a philosophy. It's not only the activities. It's these other aspects too. And so Jennifer Brush does whatever training in the States, and you can do online training with her, or facilities can buy her services and get trained up to be a Montessori prepared environment.
Yes. Yeah. So as we're talking about this, then if an SLP was working in a nursing facility and this sounded really interesting to them, it would take more than just that individual, because it's not just something just the SLP can do per se.
Exactly.
But the resources you've provided, I think, really include information on how an SLP could advocate for this philosophy or approach in the setting that they're working. Because, I mean, even the example you gave about dehydration, this is not only quality of life, but there are medical cost ramifications.
Exactly.
The medications clients are taking and more.
Yeah, facilities really like that.
Yes, exactly. We got to speak to our audience, right? Yes.
Yeah. It saves them money.
As you're describing some of these roles that clients can have with this Montessori approach, where do you see the SLP kind of in our current setting where we have our time slots with a client and we're billing for that certain time spent with them? How could we, I guess I'm just thinking through people who would ask, like, well, how can I show that this is billable time? Would the SLP use therapy time to kind of figure out what type of role would be meaningful to the client, like maybe try out a couple different things, or used spaced retrieval training to train them how to do a task?
Exactly. I view the role of the speech pathologist to figure out what kind of cues, what kind of activities, what kind of things that person would like to be able to do, and then set up the support system for that. That includes having some way of cueing that person to do these things. So that's a memory task. Maybe they need a calendar or whatever. They need training, and spaced retrieval is the ideal way to do it, to remember to look at their calendar every day, to cross things off as they do it, whatever. Some kind of a system that will help them support their doing all these activities and things.
Yeah.
And frankly, you know, I don't think there's any point in focusing on attention and executive, I mean, although executive function is calendar work. So if they're getting to their activities because they're successfully looking at their calendar every morning after they have breakfast or whatever cue you attach to that activity using space retrieval, then you can document that their executive functioning got better because now they're going to appointments or activities and whatever. But all the other impairment-based things that you would want to, you know, that you may be trying to measure and trying to do something about are only in the abstract as concepts going to get worse. Dementia is a degenerative disease. People get worse. However, if you set up cues and a system, they can maintain their activities in spite of their declining impairments. And that's what's really important.
Yeah.
In my early work, I always gave people, you know, 30 years ago, I used to give them the mini mental. And over the course of the time that I was doing a study with them, I would give the mini mental multiple times. And they always got worse on that mini mental. However, they always got better at having conversations and talking more and doing these other behaviors. So it's not about those impairments. It's about functional behavior, meaningful things that they want to be doing.
So I hear what you're saying, and I just want to make it crystal clear for people who might be listening, because sometimes it's called the cognitive stimulation approach is used in therapy, where we kind of have this idea like, well, as long as I'm working with someone with dementia and I'm just doing anything that makes their brain think, we can play an app on the iPad, we could play a card game, we can do a little Pinterest craft project, then that's speech therapy, because that I'm just offering them stimulation opportunity. I'm hearing that a lot. I'm seeing that a lot. What would your response to that idea be as us do, like that's how we're choosing to spend speech therapy time?
So to me, those kinds of activities, if the person enjoys them, are fine, but that is not skilled service to me. Those are the types of activities that the activity person who can set up and have available to the person. Our skilled service involves figuring out a way for that individual to get to those activities independently or whatever, using a calendar, and that's what we should be doing. And giving them worksheets and those activities is not going to improve any cognitive function. It's going to improve the amount of time they're engaged in an activity. Yes. That could improve their satisfaction, their life satisfaction. Mm-hmm. That could contribute to reducing their level of depression. I mean, measuring depression is something that you could measure as a function of your getting, helping that person do activities that are meaningful to them.
Yes.
And I do measure, that's something that I do measure as an outcome for many people who are sad or depressed, or you think they might be. There are simple depression measures that easily monitor that, and you can demonstrate change on that if the person's happy.
So I hear you saying then that, you know, doing card games isn't always bad. There are going to be clients who maybe want to be able to play solitaire just as a meaningful activity, or be able to, you know, play poker with some other residents. But in those cases, we're providing the right level of supports or practice in order to, the goal is engagement. It's very different than having the philosophy of, I'm going to be doing these card games so that your attention can improve, so that you can, you know, order your meal without getting distracted or something like that.
Right.
If that was the goal, then we would just want to practice providing supports for ordering the meal.
Right.
It's always about that context that we are trying to meet.
And if they like card games, they should be playing card games with their peers, with other patients or residents, not with you as the clinician.
Yes. Yes. Fantastic.
And in fact, many of these card games, they can do independently because of procedural memory. If they've played cards their whole life, they know how to do it. And it's not a matter of teaching them that. It's a matter of creating the opportunity for it to do it independently with other people.
And I also think that we need to broadly consider the ways they want to spend their time, not just always almost choose cards are fun, so that's how you're going to want to spend your time. That might be one thing, but there are many, many other ways that people may enjoy spending their time
on too. I've done a whole bunch of research on how you get people with dementia to make decisions and to choose what they want.
Yes. Yes.
And that with visual supports, you can, I've done research with people at the end of life choosing whether or not they want a feeding tube. And they can, I have data, it's published, that demonstrates that they can reliably and consistently make the same choices with written supports. Without it, they can't, because they can't hold on to the information in their impaired short-term or working memory. But with it written down, they can read that and have that continually activated, and they could make reliable choices. It's absolutely remarkable to see this. And we often have to demonstrate that patients are making these decisions independently in front of their relatives, because their relatives often have a different opinion about what should happen.
Right.
And unfortunately, because most people don't think people with dementia are reliable, they go with their family member's opinion. And that's unfortunate because their wishes are not being met.
Right.
In that case.
That I know one of the resources you've created is called Voice My Choice. Mm-hmm. And we'll put the links in the show notes. I could see that being part of that very first visit, making sure when SLPs are working in a certain setting that they have some of those supports ready to go so that they can start using those to discover what those needs are for clients, their preferences.
So let me just add something about that. I'm not advocating that people go and buy that product because it is actually quite limited in terms of what choices. Instead, what I recommend is people go around your facility and take pictures on your iPhone of the activities that are offered there or the actual food that's offered there, and make a little AAC spreadsheet of it, and, or individual cards. And you can have people say, if they like doing it or not, you can say yes or no, or you can have them say whether they like to do it sometimes, always, or never, depending on, what the activities are. And you'll be surprised at how easily people engage in that activity and can make these decisions on their own. But I would, just a caveat, I did some of those studies with nursing assistants doing that act, having the nursing assistant ask the person what their preferences were. And I have audio tape of a nursing assistant must have given the person the bingo card, and the person puts it on the mat, on the block that said never. And the nursing assistant goes, oh, no, you must not have understood me. It's bingo. How often do you enjoy playing bingo? And you hear on the tape the resident take the card and whack it on the table on never.
No, you misunderstood me. I do not like bingo.
I hate bingo. So, it's really our job too, yes. Our other job as clinicians is to help the staff communicate with people and to accept what their opinion is. And if you have a tool like that where you can show them this is what they like and what they don't like, that can be helpful as well.
Yes. Oh, that is wonderful. That's great advice. I hope our listeners are kind of, their minds are spinning. It wouldn't take that much work to just commit to like going around, snapping those photos, having them printed out, and then you can use them for a while. It would really be a big, big payout for the time spent.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
We've kind of circled around the topic of goals, and I thought I would just like come back to that so we can talk specifically about writing goals. We've been talking about like maybe the best way to spend our time isn't by doing things that are trying to improve attention or memory or executive function, like so isolated, but really within the context of meaningful activity, being able to participate. And so I know you were so kind to create and send a list of functional goals that we'll have available on the website. And is there anything you wanted to just mention about how we can be thinking about writing goals that really matter and capture the improvement we're hoping to make?
Yes. So when you see those goals, you'll see they look quite different than what you probably are writing. And that's purposeful because I really want people to understand that what we're trying to do as clinicians is improve the quality of life of our residents, our patients. And the quality of life is a bigger goal. It's kind of like the long-term goal, if you're used to writing long-term and short-term goals. The long-term goal is improving quality of life. And there are measures of quality of life that you can give to a person, life satisfaction outcomes. And I've also given you a reference to the NIH toolkit that has specific patient-reported outcomes that I predict are going to be expected that people will be using those in the coming years, because the government and Medicare want to have us be doing things that are meaningful and important. So they want us, and they want the patients and their families to recognize that what we're doing is meaningful and important. So the bigger picture is quality of life. Are they enjoying life? Are they are they engaged in meaningful activities? And then the short-term goals are things like, are they using their visual supports to get them to these activities? I have to point out that things like memory books and spaced retrieval are not interventions. Those are instructional approaches. Memory books are the cues. They're the stimuli. A training procedure like spaced retrieval is an instructional approach. It's not an intervention. The intervention is to increase the frequency of time that somebody participates in an activity because you have used spaced retrieval to teach them to look at their calendar in the morning that helps them to remember to go. So I find that is something that many clinicians are confused by. They think that spaced retrieval is an intervention. It's not. It's an instructional approach, just like a queuing hierarchy is an instructional approach.
Yes, like I've seen sometimes, I think with spaced retrieval, sometimes people confuse it with thinking like, I'm just going to do spaced retrieval and that's just generically going to improve someone's memory. Like, no. Oh, we're going to do spaced retrieval to learn my name or to say names of fruits or things like that. But really, spaced retrieval is that instructional method to train something that's going to be used regularly.
Right.
Whether it's vocabulary or to do something or to reference a cognitive aid.
It's not used for vocabulary. You don't need that kind of, unless there was, you know, somebody's name that was really important, like the nurse or whatever.
Yes.
But space usually will be used limitedly for individual words.
It's right.
It works better. It works best for teaching them to access a strategy.
Yes.
So I like to teach people to access the cat, to read the calendar. That's a strategy for remembering to do their activities. Yeah. And a strategy has much more generalization ability. So for example, in the Montessori approach, another thing that is done is that everyone wears name tags. The staff wear name tags, and a name tag that is just their name, not all the other stuff that's irrelevant, just their name. The residents all wear name tags. That's all the people that work in the environment. The visitors who come, there's a little table with name tags that people put on. And when everybody is wearing a name tag, everybody knows everybody's name because they automatically read it. And it needs to be up on the shoulder, okay, so that it's easily seen, not on a lanyard by their stomach. That's useless. It needs to be up on their shoulder. But when everybody is wearing a name tag, you only have to teach by space retrieval, if you even do. How do you know somebody's name? Oh, I read their name tag. You don't have to teach individual names. You just teach them to look at the name tag.
Strategy.
Then they know everybody's name. It has an amazing effect on the individuals in terms of feeling at home. Now they're in a familiar environment because they know everybody because everybody has a name tag.
I love the idea, too, of everyone, resident, employee, just all having the same system that feels like we're all equal parts of this community and all of our roles matter. That's really such a simple but beautiful example. So, I will go ahead and include all of the specific goals you included for us in the show notes. And I also wanted to just circle back to those patient-reported outcome measures. We'll include the links to those. And the cool thing about patient-reported outcome measures is they do have a score associated with them. So I've found those helpful in that long-term goal setting also, if we're looking at those things that feel tricky to measure, your satisfaction or participation or quality of life, well, this is a way to actually get a score. And that score could improve even if someone's impairment is not improving. So
yeah,
I love that the insurance companies, for example, are now really getting on board with patient-reported outcomes. I think that is a factor that will help us make the changes we need to make in skilled nursing facilities, for example. And with these populations where we're making a big difference in speech therapy, but not necessarily with impairment improvement. Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing those.
So let me bring up also one of the things that clinicians do a lot of in skilled nursing facilities, and that's swallowing therapy.
Yes, a lot.
So I would like people to know about the article by Benegas and Bourgeois that is a demonstration of using space retrieval to teach moderate to severely impaired people with diagnosed dementia and dysphagia to use safe swallowing cards, to read safe swallowing cards while they are eating. And it was just remarkable. You know, Jeanette Benegas, my student at the time, was just bowled over. She'd done swallowing therapy for years and had never had much success with people with dementia until she developed this intervention with the safe swallowing steps. Each person had their own individual ones. There were usually three or four cards at the most.
Okay.
But the space retrieval training to, what are you going to do to eat safely? I'm going to follow my steps. And then they followed their steps. And all of these people in her study got on a less restrictive diet.
Wow.
They maintain their ability to eat safely. And it was simple. And then because it was based on reading the cards, the swallowing steps, written cues, anybody else, you know, any other staff, the family, whatever, could use those same cards and maintain the safe eating behavior. So that's really important.
That is very important. I mean, it just kind of ties in with what we've been talking about, how we have so many opportunities to use the written cues and really make a difference in quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Another example that I'd like to bring up is medication, independent medication use. At a rehab hospital that I was working at, their big problem was they couldn't get people discharged home because their goal for medication self-management was so terrible. They were required to make sure that the patient understood what each pill was for, what the name was. I mean, and when I came in, because they asked me to consult about this, how to help these people, I said, why? Why do they need to know the name? And why can't they use a pill box and safely take the pills on whatever schedule they need to take them on by using a visual support? And it was like,
a lot of the general population doesn't know.
You can do that in therapy with, you know, like jelly beans or whatever, different colored, you know, little candies or something to practice doing that, but using space retrieval to teach them. So how are you going to take your medicines every day? Oh, I'm going to use my medicine box and look at here. It says Monday, AM. I'm going to take my morning medicine, whatever. Using a strategy offers much more opportunity for generalization and for maintaining a positive behavior for a longer time.
One question that pops up with SLPs is then who is not appropriate for therapy? There is kind of this thought sometimes, and I know there's different like levels or rating systems that are commonly used. And there's kind of like a tendency to have like this generic system where it's like, okay, if someone is this level or above, they get therapy. If they're this level or below, they don't get therapy. How would you respond to that problem?
So one of the important things to note is that all of the intervention research that I've done over the past 30 years and my colleagues have done are not done with a specific subpopulation of dementia patients at some level. The dementia patients are at all levels, and the intervention is modified or tweaked a little bit to allow that person to be successful. So the whole idea about what size of type the memory book should be is all about the higher functioning people can read smaller print, but the low functioning people, they can still read as long as it's bigger print. Right. So adjusting the intervention to meet their needs. In my estimation, there is not a single patient who's not a potential responder to therapy of some sort. Everybody needs to be having something meaningful to do. Yes. And those patients who cry out and scream, who are repetitive vocalizers, those people are trying to tell you that they are bored. They need something meaningful to do. So usually one of my favorite things to do is to go into a facility that where I've been asked to consult and identify that screamer. And I go right to that person and I try and figure out something that will be interesting to that person to engage them. And all the screaming goes away and they think I'm a miracle worker. And that's what I recommend clinicians do. Because usually it's just a matter of, you know, they're sitting in a wheelchair doing nothing, sitting in the hallway. I would scream too, wouldn't you?
Right. Yes. Yes, I would. I mean,
it's common sense that everybody, even people at the end of life, need something meaningful. And so at the end of life, if you have people who still, you know, have billable hours that, you know, you can bill for, think about what it is that would be meaningful to them at the end of life. I'm happy to report that some colleagues of mine are writing a textbook on end-of-life communication, because I think we need to, as clinicians, step up to the plate to help in hospice and at end of life with the communication aspect. People who are dying have things to say. They may need to say they're sorry to somebody. They may need to thank somebody. They may need to tell you where the safe deposit key is hidden. There, you know, there may be important things. And our job as speech pathologists is to mediate that communication. So there are ways that we can do that. And we can sit with someone and talk to them about how they want to be remembered. You can sit and write an obituary with someone without calling it that, but you can, and families are very appreciative of that kind of interaction that you have with someone. And I had this realization a few years ago when my grandmother died. I was very close to her, but I didn't live anywhere near her when she passed. And when I went to the funeral, this woman who happened to be a minister got up and told all the family that the service that we were going to be experiencing was all my grandmother's favorite prayers, her favorite hymns. And we couldn't, I mean, it just blew me away, because I wouldn't have known that.
Right.
The other family members wouldn't have known that. But how important, you know, how meaningful it was to all of us that her funeral
chose that.
She helped us figure that out. That is something that we can do as speech pathologists. I mean, just simply asking them, so do you have special hymns that you like?
Right.
You know, what prayers do you like? Shall we pray? You know, shall we, can I pray that, you know, whatever. I mean, those are important things that are meaningful at the end of life. And I'm hopeful that once this textbook is out, that speech pathologists will learn that they are capable of doing something very important. And it's language, right?
Yes.
It's memory.
Oh,
it's so whatever important. You want to bill for, it can be, you know, part of it.
I look forward to reading that textbook. And I know once we understand that as a group of speech pathologists, like, then it's our job to kind of go outward and make sure other professionals understand. Yeah. Just this month, I had a client in my private practice diagnosed with ALS, and the neurologist told this client, stop doing speech therapy. You just have to focus on your swallow now. And so I circled back. I came back to them and just had to provide so much education that even if they lose their ability to produce voice, that there's still so much to communicate. And we are specialists at how to do that. So I couldn't agree more that we have a role there. And it's kind of like our torch now to kind of keep pushing that forward in our profession.
And so I've worked in an ALS clinic too, where I was appalled. Absolutely appalled at the neurologists and the other professionals who, once that person was at the point where they were not able to swallow anymore, was all about that and not about, okay, it's inevitable that this person is going to die.
Right.
There are things, there is a lot of other stuff that needs to happen, conversations with this person, message banking.
Yes.
I mean, that person's I mean, I don't get me started on that. One of my pet peeves, neurologists in ALS clinics. We have a lot to share with our other professionals. And
yes.
And I'm happy, very happy that the future clinicians and people who read these books and take it on will make a difference. So That's good.
Well, this is a nice point for us to wrap up. And so let me just say, like, I thank you from our whole profession for the very strong and wide foundation you've provided for us so that we can continue these conversations about person-centered care, meaningful dementia therapy, end of life care and communication. If you have any parting thoughts, as I know you recently retired, is there anything that you would like to kind of end by saying?
Well, again, thank you for inviting me to do this. I am very happy to retire knowing that I have taught many people to continue on with this and expand my thinking on this. And there are quite a few people out there who are following in my footsteps. And I am convinced that by the time I get to a nursing home, it's going to be better.
Yes. Yes. I love that. We will hold on to that vision. I just wanted to say to our listeners, thank you so much for listening to the Speech Uncensored podcast today and our conversation. You will find all of our show notes, a discussion guide, just tons of fantastic resources, including Michelle's references and her publications, which would be just awesome to study with your group of SLPs and talk about what changes you can make. All of that stuff will be at speechuncensored.com. And I appreciate you spending your time nourishing your brain so your practice can flourish. Let's get out there and make therapy meaningful.